Welcome to a podcast of The Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
We've found something extraordinary. Disturbing, that is. You recall what you said about how polar melting might disrupt the North Atlantic current?
Yes.
Well, I think it's happening.
Government has to start making long-term preparations now.
Jack, all you have is a theory.
It's been raining like days now.
Mr. Vice President, if we don't act now, it's going to be too late.
I'm afraid that time has come and gone, my friend.
What can we do?
Save as many as you can.
Meteorologists are at a loss to explain what is causing this weather.
Are you getting this on camera?
What you see is happening now.
There is so much damage.
Javier was battered by the largest hailstorm on record.
Weather experts yesterday slamming into the
area. New Delhi, it's snowing.
It's a tornado! Yes, a twister!
This is just massive.
It has light coverage.
There is a wall of water coming towards New York City. Everybody, get out of here!
Ladies and gentlemen, we're screwed.
Oh.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Andy's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a pierogi's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program. Heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Planets are in the main.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. He's a legendary, charismatic megafauna in his own mind. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Well, I'm here. Lisa's here.
I'm here.
That's good. Carol is on the way. Apparently, she's out of her, her alley. And if she had made it to the streets, she would have been okay. All she had to do was, and I was worried about that coming out today, too.
Well, I would say the main streets are fine. The side streets are a disaster.
In order, the main streets are pretty good. The side streets are not very good. The alleys are
disaster.
That's where the disaster is.
Yeah.
And what I did, I got a running start out of my garage. I just decided,
punched it.
I said I had a little path cleared out, and I said I'm just getting into the rut, and I'm going, and because I don't trust that if I stop, I'll be able to get going again. And actually, I did stop, but I got going and got out of there. And once I got to the street, I was okay. It's only going to get worse in side streets and the alleys.
Well, and especially as the temperatures drop, everything that's on the ground is going to become ice.
And just so you know, at 9:30, we're going to Rick DeMaio early today.
We can use a half hour of weather today.
Yeah, we're going to have a half hour of weather. The most comprehensive weather segment in Chicago today will be on the Mike Novak Show on WCPT 820 AM. 92.7, 92.5, and 99.9 FM. Chicago's Progressive Talk. So there you go. It pays to have your own meteorologist sometimes, especially when the bad weather hits on a Sunday morning. And there are some changes today on the station, and one of which is second. But now, assuming our next host can make it, at 11 a.m., We have a new show, which means that you and I got to duck out of here very quickly. And Denny knows that, too. Yeah, Denny's nodding. He said, we're gonna have to jump out of here. Denny, just grab the mic there. Good to have you here, and Happy New Year to you.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it. Oh, there we go. There's the mic.
And you made it in here.
Somehow, yeah. Man.
It was pretty bad getting in.
Well, you're a public transportation guy.
I'm thinking about what Carol's going through right now, and it's kind of worrying.
Yeah, she's waiting for a bus. I told her to grab a cab if she sees one, but there probably is no cab to be had out there at the moment.
They wouldn't take me all the way to Milwaukee. I'd pull
from
a cab
where?
Over and be like, hey, can I get a ride? Like, where are you going? I'd be like, Milwaukee. I was at, like, Foster and Broadway.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, can I go to Milwaukee? Like, I'm not going that far. Like, oh.
Did he think
you know why?
The city?
No.
I mean, what do you think? It's not that far.
I know. Wouldn't
That's
go
what,
that
two and
far.
A half, 3 miles?
I'm so discouraged.
Wow.
Wow. You know what I think it is? And I hate to say it's that prejudice of cabs not wanting to go west of Ashland.
Yeah.
You know, once you're west, sometimes it's Western Avenue. Sometimes it's just Ashland. It's like these cabbies, they know that's not where the money is. So they just stay east of Ashland.
They're not going to pick up a new rider?
They're not going to pick up poor people. You know, they're not going to go in an area where there aren't lots of people grabbing cabs.
I would have given the guy tons of money to take me to Milwaukee.
He could have been finishing a shift, too, and if it's the opposite direction where he lives.
That might be, I would give him credit. I don't know that I would do that.
So I came all the way in from Glen Ellen. And so I was on 355, 88, to the mall. There, it was, you know, the stuff between the tires of your car was all messy. You couldn't really see the lines, but there was, you know, a cow path to follow.
Yeah, well, and in the city, to the city's credit, I got on Kedzie, and it was wet, and I was surprised.
Clear as can be.
The freeways were so, and I think a lot of it has to do with it being a Sunday morning where they are able to get ahead
of
the game.
They had lots of warning about what was headed
right
away.
Snow continues to come down. Rick DeMaio will be here at 9:30, tell you how much more. And then
Rick DeMaio is going to be the star at today's show.
He is, absolutely.
Isn't he?
Even with Joel Greenberg being on in the second hour, I think Rick DeMaio is, I think folks who are listening now are going to want to catch DeMaio's report.
Oh, man.
At 9:30. And, of course, talking about the life-changing cold weather coming in. And thank goodness we're going to have a blanket of snow, because this would be brutal for plants. It's still going to be brutal for people. I was telling Denny, okay. I remember the last time we had these temperatures. Lisa, were you in town in 83?
I was in Antioch.
So you know what we're talking about.
Yep.
25 below.
Yep.
Okay. Denny, you were telling me this morning that...
Three.
Because Denny just had a birthday.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just turned 30.
And I like the way you put it, that you're ahead of the game because you're already bald.
Oh, I went bald.
So for all those guys freaking out when they turn 30, because, oh, my God, I might start to lose my hair. You're like, I got that one licked.
Yeah, that's
I'm done.
Nothing.
I've moved on.
Yeah.
You move on to more serious things. But what was it? How did you describe it this morning?
Well, they're saying on the news, like, if you're under 40, you have never experienced what's about to happen here in the next few days.
Right. There are advantages to being older. Is having lived through it. And I was telling Denny that one of the things you want to do, now you don't want to go out for a real long time necessarily, but go outside when it's 19 below.
You're crazy.
Feel it?
Go feel it. You got to experience it. It's like when it's 105, I want to know what that feels like. I really do. I really want to know what that, not for a long time necessarily.
Yeah.
But.
Well, I think Fargo, they're calling for negative 74.
Well, wind chills don't count. I want to know what the actual temperature is. You know,
Well, I think that's negative 35
for a guy.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Done. So Rick will tell us about that as well.
Yeah.
But Denny, now, 30 years from now, when you're talking to some punk who's never experienced. Well, that,
oh,
course,
yeah,
we
that'd
may
be,
never
be
get
awesome.
This. Hey, with climate change, we never get this again. You never know.
Oh, man. Well, I hope I can tell somebody about this when I'm older.
I don't know, because it's bringing extremes. On both ends of...
Yeah, and that's part of the deal, so, as you know.
Yeah, because last year, in January, seen record lows in Siberia. Now think about that. Russia, record lows, Siberia.
Yikes.
At the same time, Australia was recording record highs the same day.
Mm-hmm.
So, pretty remarkable.
I'm frightened. For a guy who's just to wait for the bus, standing there, negative 50, I heard. That's frightening.
That is. Now, people outside, people have to go to work, people have to take mass transportation. Just being out is going to be dangerous. Yep. And I know the Chicago Public Schools, I heard this morning, they will be. Yeah. And I'm not surprised, though. That's really not necessarily a bad thing, because for folks who can't afford daycare, folks have
who
to go.
Who just came off the Christmas break.
Who came off the Christmas break, who had their unemployment benefits chopped off at the knees. You know, I can understand. I was talking to a friend who's a teacher, and she said, we're going to be open. And because there's some people who have no place else to go except to school. And I understand this. So apparently, from what I've heard, Chicago Public Schools will be heating up the buildings today to make sure they're ready to go for tomorrow, which makes a lot of sense.
Well, sure, because the furniture is cold. I know just in my own office.
Not just the furniture, but...
You have to overcome the thermal mass of everything that's in the building, not just warm the building.
So, words of a great talk show host.
Oh, it didn't happen.
Letterman. Wait a second.
That would have been great.
I thought that bump. Okay, hold on.
Should we just ad lib for it? Because we all know the line.
No. It's locked. I'm locked out here. I can't get to.
Uh-oh.
Danny, you're going to have to come in because I need to be able to play this. So.
Absolutely. But you did mention the new show that's coming on right
now. Yes, just before we get to our brand new segment today, Out Chicago. Yeah, I got distracted as I always do. I'm highly distractible, as you know. The only local and live LGBT show, I was trying to get this one going for the array, and I don't know why it's on phone. And then I reset 4, and I thought it should go, but you can turn that. The only local and live LGBT show in the Chicago metro area. Oh, there it is. Okay. Is it there? And this is what I wanted to play.
Ladies and gentlemen. We're screwed.
Yes, exactly. Starting at 11 a.m. today and going to 1 p.m. on WCPT and every week right after the Mike Novak Show, Out Chicago, a new show about LGBT life, current events, and civil rights hosted by Scott Duff. Scott is Chicago-based actor, comedian, theater educator, and activist. Sound familiar?
Hmm. You got to. That's that those, kind of a bio.
Those are the shows here. He's a graduate of Northwestern, a founding member of About Face Theater, he's performed with The Goodman, Steppenwolf, Looking Glass, and Chicago Shakespeare Theater, and that show starts at 11 a.m. today till 1 p.m. and will be every week following the Mike Novak Show. And it's 9:15.
Time for,
I don't know what it's time for.
We don't have
because I don't have a name for the segment yet. It's a brand new segment on the Mike Novak Show.
The Green Room. No?
Wow.
You like that?
I kind of like that.
Denny's so sharp.
You've been thinking about this, haven't you?
About that a few days ago, actually.
Yeah, we talked about it. I like it.
The Green Room. He's clever, that man.
And I mentioned this last week on the show that, you know, folks... they need their gardening fix. And sometimes I have gotten to it, and sometimes I haven't on the show. And I've decided 9:15 every day, every Sunday, rather. We'll do at least 15 minutes of gardening. Maybe that's the – I was thinking that could be the title of the segment, at least 15 minutes of gardening. The Green Room, kind of like that. I had a friend of mine on Twitter who was tweeting some ideas – it was Margaret Sheehan who said, garden question time in a garden de vita. I kind of like that one, actually. Up the garden spout? I don't think so. Inch by inch, row by row? No. And there's another one that I'm not actually going to say. I like the Green Room. Thank you, Denny Sheeter. That's on.
Anytime.
Okay. Your royalty check is in the mail. I just saw somebody tweet, John R. tweeted, so much salt. I know it's a safety issue, but good grief. And that's what we're talking about this morning on The Green Room. Maybe we call it In The Green Room. but it is that question, salt. And stuff that you put on your sidewalk, you put on your driveway, your what?
Well, it ends up on your plants.
Well, it ends up on your plants. The other place it ends up is in the waterways.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the problem, is that regardless of how safe you feel and how important it is to keep the wheels of industry moving, that stuff's got to go someplace. Okay. And you need to be careful about what you're putting down, especially if you got plants. I have a bunch of links up on my website, MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show. And one of the things, articles that I link to is a site called Green Venture in Canada. Now, you've probably heard that there are alternatives to sodium chloride, magnesium chloride, potassium chloride, calcium chloride, and ferrocyanide salts. And here's what Green Venture wrote about that. It says, in August 2000, Environment Canada, and I guess they should know about this stuff, completed a 5-year study of the effects of road salt on the environment. They concluded that road salts, the ones I mentioned, sodium chloride, calcium chloride, potassium chloride, magnesium chloride, are toxic to the environment, particularly in large concentrations. In the United States, de-icing salt is considered a possible pollutant under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES. The heavy use of road salts can lead to damage to vegetation, to your plants, especially, you know, if you've got them along the sidewalk. And what happens when you're shoveling, of course, you put the salt down and then you pile it in an area. And this is a tip for you if you're going to use these salts. Don't pile it all in one place, even though it seems to be the best place. If there's a way you can spread it out, that is going to be helpful. So that way, not one plant takes the whole brunt of the salt. Now, going on with the article, the heavy use of road salts can lead to damage to vegetation, organisms in soil, birds, and other wildlife. Almost all chloride ions from road salts eventually find their way into waterways, whether by direct runoff into surface water or by moving through the soil and groundwater. In surface water, road salts can harm freshwater plants, fish, and other organisms that are not adapted to living in saline waters. But it doesn't stop there, and according to the article on Green Venture. Road salts could, they also threaten drinking water security. For example, the region of Waterloo in Canada has found chloride levels in its municipal water wells as high as 233 megagrams per liter, close to the unsafe level of 250 megagrams per liter set by the Ministry of the Environment. So this can contaminate your water as well. So that's something you need to consider when you are applying stuff on this. Now, a lot of folks say that the best, there's that same site has other ideas about how to keep up with the problem of traction. For instance, non-clumping kitty litter is an idea that you might want to try, or sand. When I used to be out in the Pacific Northwest a lot, because they don't get quite the same weather that we do here, they use sand a lot out there. I don't know if you've ever, and it's one of the reasons their cars don't get all
corroded. Sand, does sand cause trouble, you know, with your, like, you know, in the pipes and stuff. So that gets accumulated, you know, like, so it, so in the drainage system, doesn't it settle down and it's hard to, I would think that would add up.
That's a Ron Cowgill question, isn't it?
That is Ron Cowgill question.
So Ron, if you're listening and you got a,
because he usually texts me answers to my questions.
And there's something, there's an article I just got information from the Morton Arboretum on Friday. Now they're talking about a product they use, a beet juice mixed with rock salt. Now this is not new.
Beet juice?
Beet juice. Yeah. It's been out for some years. I, was doing some research yesterday and found and saw that as early as, 2008 folks were writing about it. What the Morton Arboretum says is that, of course, rock salt or sodium chloride can dry out landscape plants, which causes damage that may not be visible until spring or even years later. And that's something to take to keep in mind. Sometimes you see damage. It might be weather related. It might be salt related. And it doesn't show up for a long time. And you're wondering, well, weather's not bad outside right now. How come my plants are like this? Well, sometimes it's a delayed reaction, and some of the problem might be salt, that sodium chloride that you put down on your walkway. The risk is greatest for plants along drives and walkways, as I said. To minimize damage, the Arboretum looked to National Seed in Lyle, which provides the beet juice used for the mixture called Ice Bite. Okay, I could make a joke about that, too.
Is there that much beet juice available in the community?
Well, it says that the beet juice is an effective alternative to salt alone because it lowers the freezing point of water to as low as minus 20.
And then is your snow pink?
And that's a good question. I'm not sure. I don't know. I think there's other kinds of beet, you know, there's different colors of beets you can get, too.
Maybe I could use kale juice on one side of the sidewalk and beet juice on the other side.
And then have a salad and just roll in it.
Festive, Christmassy-looking sidewalk.
So while beet juice lowers the freezing point of water to minus 20, salt only prevents water from freezing at temperatures of 5 degrees or higher, which means that come the cold we have in the next few days, it's not going to be very effective. Of course, salt also bounces from the roads. Adding beet juice lowers the bounce rate from 30% to 5%, reducing the amount of salt used on the roads. With the new product, the Arboretum is using 9 times less salt. Calculations, nearly $14,000 in material costs. That's pretty amazing. And I also, but I note on my website, and again, you can go to MikeNovak.net, this week's show, even beet juice isn't completely innocuous, according to Mother Nature Network. And this is an article from 2009. Adding it to water can have an impact, according to an assistant professor of environmental science at University of Maryland's Chesapeake Biological Lab and lead author of a PNAS study, Organic Matter. Let's see. This person said organic matter, anything from leaves to amino acids, anything carbon based that breaks down needs to consume oxygen. Oxygen depleted water can come at an environmental cost. In one of the most extreme cases of oxygen depletion, known as hypoxia, more than 22,000 square kilometers in the Gulf of Mexico lost much of its commercial fishing industry. Now, I don't know if they're talking about the dead zone there, but it's quite likely that's what they're talking about. And dead zones show up all over the planet in oceans. So it's something to think about, even if you're using beet juice. So some people say the best alternative, and this sounds like common sense, is just keep ahead of it. You know, get the snow off before it freezes, before it becomes ice, and maybe add a little sand to it or a little kitty litter for traction if that's what you're worried about. Otherwise, you're putting stuff especially rock salt, because that's the cheapest, it's the most common, and that's what folks buy. They go to the store and they, I mean, I got some magnesium sulfate, not sulfate, magnesium chloride, and I put that down because I know it's safer on the plants, but I still worry about it. Water table, so I've been, I only used it once, I got to tell you. I might use it in the next day or two when it's really crazy, a little bit, but not much. So I guess my advice is go easy on the stuff we had. So
my thought is just that I would shovel often.
Yeah.
I'd just shovel
early and often.
Mm-hmm. And not everybody in my building has the same.
I know. Problem. I understand.
Which is frustrating.
And a tweet from a listener says, but what about when the beet juice supply runs out for cyclists?
Cyclists?
I don't get that.
I don't know. Do
cyclists drink a lot of beet juice?
I don't know.
Is there such a thing as beet juice for cyclists? I have no idea what that means.
And Ron Cowgill did me a text message. He said he never thought about the problem of sand accumulation in your sewer system, but yeah. He thought that would be a bad idea. Can't be good to have that much sand accumulation.
All right. Well, anyway, that's...
Does Rick call us or do we call Rick?
You give Rick a call.
I'm going to work on that.
All right. Why don't you do that? Because he's already sent me some road reports. We're going to get to Rick DeMaio in just a second. Thanks for being with us in the green room on the Mike Novak Show. Denny likes it. Is it okay if we modify a little bit, call it in the green room? Does that work for you? Okay, good. Rick DeMaio weather, full forecast for the rest of the day and for the nasty few days coming up, if you'll just stick around. Now, if you're a gardening fan and not a football fan, this is one of those Sundays that will have you climbing the walls. As you look out on a foot and a half of snow insulation for your plants, you'll be drawing imaginary circles and triangles and parallelograms on that blanket of white, planning your garden for the coming year. Ah, my tortured friends, you need a copy of the January-February issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. It's called The Ideas Issue, and in it, you will find inspiration for the whole season. One of those ideas is an article called Ditch the Dirt. Yep, we're talking about hydroponics. My buddy Mr. Brown Thumb penned the story, and he asked the musical question, how bad can a system be that was used by the ancient Babylonians, the Aztecs, NASA, and even Walt Disney World's Epcot Center? Sounds like mainstream to me. Then there's my column on the inside back page of every issue. Sounds like total lamestream, which should make Sarah Palin happy. Pick up a copy of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. Better yet, get a subscription. Go to chicagolandgardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-3600.
Trying to weather the housing market? Consider replacing your windows and siding. Remodeling Magazine says they're some of the nation's most popular projects today.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling and energy needs. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I don't want you to be left out. Here's what I'm talking about. Each month, turn to Natural Awakening Chicago to improve their lives than any other health or wellness magazine. If you're a green, natural health, or wellness business, you should be part of the leading sustainability resource in the country. Natural Awakenings is packed with information that arts and services they need to live happier, healthier lives. Natural Awakenings is available for free each month throughout the city and north and northwest suburbs. We're placed in more than 1,100 area locations, ensuring the right eyes read about your products and services. We're also online at nachicagonorth.com. We're local, we're independent, and our readers will help you grow your business. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. You might be waking up this morning and saying, yikes. or perhaps even something a little stronger, as you see your trees and shrubs weighed down from what has been some pretty heavy snow. Talking me about this the other day, snow and especially ice are capable of causing some real damage on your woody plants. But sometimes the best course of action is to do little or nothing at all. If it's possible, gently, and I emphasize the word gently, remove snow from tree at it and say, hey, I need to knock that off because you might knock off a branch at the same time. Now, if the snow is frozen to the plant, the best course is to let Mother Nature do her thing, which is, there is warm enough for the ice to melt. Yes, there may be some disfiguration of the tree or shrub, but it's best to wait to see if the plant can recover, afraid of it breaking, and just leave it there until the ice on it melts. If you have more questions, I suggest you invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look at your snow and ice-covered trees. 9466 for a free consultation, 800-508-9466, or go to thecareoftrees.com. Company, their business is people and their love for trees. Rick DeMille weather in 30 seconds.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
And on that note, let's go to the phone line and bring in the effervescent Rick DeMille. Rick, good morning.
Effervescent, is that like me, like on that little tablet that slides over the snow piles, that old 40s and 50s? Who's that kid for that Alka-Seltzer commercial?
Speedy, was something Speedy, Speedy, blah, blah, blah.
I think it was just Speedy.
Was it Speedy? Speedy Relief.
Relief. Hey, you actually, you plop, plop, fizz, fizz. And
oh, what a relief it is.
That was later, but yeah, you basically got relief in 29 seconds. That's what it looks like out there right now, doesn't it? Look like Speedy going through the hills of Mount Prospect and the plains of Barrington and whatever. It's
amazing. I want to say one thing, two things real quickly.
Sure.
As we get to that, I was talking a second ago about beet juice and cyclists. And I just got tweeted again, apparently, and maybe you do this, I don't know, Rick, cyclists have been using beet juice more and more. I think it's the person who wrote this says, I think it's gross because who wants to drink purple dirt, but,
I don't understand. How did the cyclists use it?
I don't know. See, this is all new to me. I thought maybe you knew something about this.
Do they have like an extension off their handlebars that drops at 20 feet in front of their tire tracks? That seems kind of weird.
Yeah. And I also wanted to let folks know that in the second hour, I kind of short shrifted Joel Greenberg, who's going to be on the air. He was supposed to be in studio. He will be on the phone because, you know, what's going on out there. We'll be talking about his new book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. This is the 100th anniversary of the death of the last passenger pigeon in the world. And guess who? Go humans. Yay.
You know, speaking of birds in this weather, Mike, I've noticed over the last 2 days the lack of tweeting. And remember, sparrows tweeted before we did. Sparrows tweeting on my back deck asking for bread. It's amazing how up and going, Rick, we need bread, because that's basically what they're saying.
Yeah.
And what I've done the last couple of days is I've actually had to remove, you know, 3 or 4 inches of snow off of my hanging plant that just continues to sit out there. I just let it go. And every morning they go out there and they get a fresh slice of wheat bread. The last couple of days they haven't been out. So I know it sounds kind of corny. We talk a lot about how we shouldn't shake the snow off the trees, but the birds need to eat as well. And when you get into situations like this where you get, you know, snow on top of snow on top of snow, I'm sure the birds have gone probably 24 hours without eating. So this is, I know, a day that you go out there and you you know, clear the snow out and put the bread out, because I'm sure the birds will eventually find it, hopefully before the squirrels do.
I was actually thinking about that. Kathleen and I were talking about that, about getting some seed or bread, yeah, whatever we had, and getting it out, because it's going to be hard on these critters. Even the squirrels are digging holes in the snow banks in my backyard, which is kind of weird.
Yeah, but oddly enough, I went out and bought some bird seed, Mike, but it didn't make the birds grow. So what's wrong with that?
Oh, no, boy.
It didn't make the birds grow. That's a joke. Brother.
I missed it.
Please, you want to explain it to them before we finish it?
No, please don't explain the joke. Please,
seeds,
don't.
Growing things.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Sorry. You know, that really was sort of, that was worthy of...
Ba-dum-bum.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, Mike, what I'd like to do here is, even though, you know, we're going to be on talking about snow and climate and stuff like that, it'd be great if you have several of your listeners call in with snow amounts. I'd like to see how this particular snow event is varying from one side of the area to the other. And it's kind of odd because of this pattern where it seems like every little light snow event that comes through northern Illinois seems to sit right over us between Rockford and Peoria and snows on us.
Yeah.
And that was the case on New Year's Eve when it seemed like we were going to get a 2 to 6 inch snow event, and it kept snowing and it kept snowing and it kept suburbs got 12 inches of snow out of what seemed to be a fairly benign, innocuous system. And then the second part kicked in the next day with an additional 2 to 4 inches. And then we had lake effect. And what was interesting about that lake effect event on New Year's Day, or at least the day after New Year's Day, was it didn't really produce the lake effect snow where you would normally get it. You got more lake effect snow in parts of western Will County and mm-hmm. eastern DuPage County. Almost 6 inches, where near the lake we got maybe 2 to 4, and that showed you the strength of the system and actually pushed the lake effect bands further inland than we would normally get. And then we get this 2 to 3 inch event last night, which was actually not even associated with the main system that's coming through now, and we'll get an additional 2 to 3 inches today on top of what we got last night. By the end of today, we could be looking at 30 inches of snow for the season, and here it is only the, 5th of January?
But you do raise an interesting point, and I think you just answered it, because I actually had somebody write to me and say, hey, why didn't Rick tell us this last Sunday? You know, because you were kind of unprepared for this as well, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think a lot of us in the meteorological community saw last week's event as a potential 4 to 6 snow event, and then you can get lake effect. And one thing I've learned about lake effect is you never go beyond 24 hours before the event and say this is how much you're going to get, because it varies so much. And a shift in the wind of 20 degrees, meaning from the northeast to the north, takes everything out over the lake and you get nothing. People go, hey, what happened to the lake effect we're going to get? But I think a lot of us, including the National Weather Service, who are, you know, the experts here, if you recall, they only had a winter weather advisory out for that system that came through on New Year's Eve. And I think probably because it didn't fit what's called their criteria of getting more than 6 inches of snow in 24 hours, they thought it was going to be a two-part event, which you could basically separate it. And then the lake effect is a third part. The problem was the first two parts kind of joined up in the middle and never stopped. But if you look at a snow map of Illinois prior to the lake effect event, the one that came through on New Year's was pretty much 2 to 4 inches south, 4 to 6 in the city, and then there was a 12-inch band in relatively narrow area across McHenry and Lake County. So I know as a citizen of the weather community, you go, you know what, we missed this. But from a mathematical standpoint, most of the area actually got the amount of snow that everybody predicted. However, That's not any consolation for people, you know, traipsing through.
Who live in Libertyville?
No, the next day.
Who live in Libertyville, right?
Oh, Libertyville! My God, that was like the center of snow. And even yesterday, driving up through northern Illinois, through northern Lake County, rather into Wisconsin, there was a huge change from a lot of snow in Illinois to nothing in Wisconsin to Milwaukee. So we have basically been at the epicenter of snow over the last almost week and a half. So I can understand why people say, hey, you guys didn't hit this. And you know what? We didn't. I mean, sometimes you got to say, you know what? We missed this. We didn't miss it by a lot, But we definitely could have forecasted more snow, without a doubt.
And since you weren't here, you haven't been here during the week, did you, have you seen this, the one that's happening last night and today, was this one pretty clearly going to hit us? Did you, could you see this coming?
It's interesting, Mike, because 3 days ago, this system looked like it was going to take a track more so through the Ohio Valley up into, say, western Pennsylvania, and each successive run of the three or four different numerical models that we all look at kept taking it further west, kept taking it further north, and you're looking at the trends, and you're going, okay, this is going to be a 1 to 2. Now it's a 2 to 4. It's like, holy smoke, this could actually be 4 to 6 inches. And I think the only thing that kept the snow from being heavier yesterday is that the temperatures actually warmed up. I mean, for the first time in a week, you walked outside, you go, wow, you know what? 30 degrees doesn't feel so bad.
Oh, it was great. We caroled last night for the final time at Illumination at the Morton Arboretum. It was a perfect evening, and with the snow, it was delightful.
And the wind lightened up as well.
Oh, it was great. It was so pretty, and people just had a wonderful time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as long as the roads stay relatively clear, people go, you know what, this isn't so bad. But, you know, you were talking about, you know, different communities using different methods to clear their roads. It's amazing when you go from Sheridan Road and 7600 North and you round the bend at the cemetery and you go into Evanston. I don't think Evanston knows what salt is.
Well, you know, if you were listening earlier, maybe that's not such a bad thing.
You know what, and I agree with you, and I was listening earlier, but I have to say, and they got to get the roads cleared a little bit better in that city. To a certain point, and this isn't because I have a lot of parking tickets and I'm mad at them, but my God, get the plows down, at least scrape the roads of snow. And I think we can all agree that there's some municipalities you can go from one to the other that
better.
Do a better job of it.
Yeah.
And I understand, and I remember when I was UW-Madison, the city of Madison hardly ever used salt. They used a lot of this combination of it was like a sand with another chemical, and it was kind of good because it kept the salt on the road, but you know what? Everybody drove around with about 1 to 2 feet of this kind of red stuff stuck to the sides of their cars, and I don't know, I guess it was good for the environment, or better for the environment, because they were worried a lot about how the salt was leaching into their groundwater and affecting the agricultural interest in those communities. And I understand that salt costs a lot of money, but when you talk about the ability to stay ahead of the game, I think certain communities do a better job than others, and clearly I think the state of Illinois deserves a pat on the back as well as the city of Chicago, because our roads are pretty darn good when we get snow. I mean, they you can move from one part of the area to the other fairly well.
By the way, speaking of the roads, you sent me information, and I want to make sure people that have it now, road reports. If you're looking for road reports in Illinois, you can call 800-452-4368, 800-452-4368. In Indiana, 800-261-7623. 800-261-7623. Now, how much snow have we gotten down, and how much more are we going to get?
You know, and great question. And just to continue on that note about road reports, one of the things that I think people need to understand is that while the roads may not be terrible today, by later on tonight, particularly during the day tomorrow when the high winds kick in out of the north, that's when those east-west roads become snow-covered with the blowing snow. So each successive snow that we get, particularly when you get what we have now, which is the dry snow, you can end up easily getting, you know, ground blizzards or drifting snow on top of the snow that fell. So while the interstates, the north-south interstates may stay okay, I understand that there's a ban on tractor-trailer trucks, particularly the double and triple ones, across I-80, 90, and from Illinois into Indiana tomorrow. Not that any of your listeners are driving those kind of trucks, but if truckers are driving and listening to you right now, there's actually a ban on those vehicles tomorrow through Illinois and Indiana due to the fact that we have strong winds kicking in later on this afternoon through tonight and literally taking the snow that's fallen and blowing it back over the roads. And this is the thing also, that airports have to deal with. And one of the things that I find fascinating about large airports, like an O'Hare, like a Denver, not so much Midway, they're more of an urban airport, but it's not so much plowing the snow, but it's figuring out where to put it.
Yeah.
Each runway, it'll literally take the snow that has fallen on the side and blow it back onto the runways. So we had 3 inches overnight. It looks like we had an additional 2.5 to 3 this morning. And our total so far for the year, we're up to 26 inches. 26 inches. We didn't get that until I think it was the middle of February last year. But this is the most snow that we've had on the ground probably since 1999. And in the cold air that kicks in later on this afternoon through tonight will be the coldest since back in 1996. So
96. So it doesn't go back really 30 years.
Well, let's qualify this.
Okay. Okay.
It'll be the coldest period of cold weather since 96, but the overnight low temperatures could be as cold as going back to 1983. Okay.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah,
okay.
Where 30 years coming from. So back in 96, we had 68 consecutive hours where the temperature was below zero, which was pretty impressive. In 83, that was during that horrible period we talked about this last week over Christmas break, where we had 98 consecutive hours of below zero temperatures. We're not going to get anywhere near that, and I don't even think we're going to get close to the 66, but we will get somewhere between, I'd say, maybe 55 to about 60, depending where you are in the metropolitan area. I think areas further west could easily exceed 80. Areas further east may be down about 40. But there's a chance, there's a pretty good chance we may actually take a at minus 20. The only thing from getting there tomorrow is the fact that the storm system has now actually moved a little bit further north and a little bit further west. So it may delay the onset of the cold air. And timing is everything with Arctic air. If you bring that through a region during the basically between about 4 a.m. and about 7 a.m., that diurnal change will usually give you a better chance of seeing temperatures reach near record lows. I don't think we're going to see that, but if we get to minus 20, that'll be the coldest since back in 1983.
That's just amazing stuff.
Well, you know the most amazing thing about all this is today is the day of what we call it the perihelion. Do you know what that is?
Yes, the perihelion, where the Earth reaches its closest point to the sun in its orbit.
And it's not doing us any good, is it?
Well, it's because, you know, and I talked about it a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, I don't know, I think it was during the solstice, and I thought that solstice was perihelion, but is today the perihelion?
Yeah, the solstice is just the longest or the shortest day of the year.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Solstice refers still.
Right.
But you can still be a little bit further away or closer. So I say, you know, it's a good thing that the sun is actually closer to us in January, because if it wasn't, we'd probably be about 5 or 8 degrees colder. So
well, okay, the question I would ask, and the reason, obviously, is that the tilt of the Earth, tilted away from the sun, which is
right.
Why we have the colder, why we have our winter now. Does that mean our winters are warmer than the southern hemisphere and their summers are hotter?
Well, our winters are generally colder because we have more land mass in the northern hemisphere. If you flip that, and we talk now about the summers in the southern hemisphere should be warmer, okay, because the sun is however, because there's more water in the southern hemisphere, it provides a little bit of a cooling effect. However, if you look at land masses such as Australia, the center of Australia, where you have 23.5 degrees south latitude, that's where the sun is directly overhead
right.
On their first day of summer, they get more sunlight, more direct, intense sunlight than anywhere else on Earth. Anywhere else on Earth on that day. And that's one of the reasons why when you see basically your outback people in Australia, they have that kind of leathery-looking, almost like yellowish-brown skin. There is more direct sunlight over that part of the Earth than the northern hemisphere anywhere else.
Lisa, I would tend to think that would make it excellent for
good solar day.
Solar.
It's an awesome solar day.
Farms down there. And especially because so much of that is desert, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and we talk, and Lisa could probably add to this. We call it the photovoltaic potential of not only how much direct sunlight is coming in, but also how much reflective sunlight is coming mm-hmm. in. Because even if you may not be getting direct sunlight through an overcast cloud deck, you can get also a lot of reflective sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the reasons why, and if Lisa, you want to add to this, we've gone away from those flat photovoltaic cells to more of a curve so you can grab even stuff that's coming off the ground?
I think you're talking about like on a big utility scale, and they're learning lots of things about how you need to really look at the microclimate of where you're at,
right,
your exact location, and that one rule of thumb doesn't always follow suit. We got a lot of phone calls this week because a lot of people were getting error messages from their reporting systems to say their system wasn't working.
Why is that?
There's snow on the panels.
Oh, of course.
And then they felt a little silly for having called.
well, you know, it's interesting, Lisa, that you mentioned, you know, snow covering things up. Believe it or not, when you get 15, 20-inch snow depths like what we have right now, and that snow blows up against the side of your house, for people who have floor, this is pretty much where your house is most insulated because that snow is actually keeping the cold air out mm-hmm. now. The other hand, if you have an old building like me where you can actually see snow on the inside of your storm windows, it's time for new windows.
Yeah.
I believe, you know, it's interesting. Kathleen and I were out yesterday doing some added protection around, you know, sealing certain areas in anticipation.
Stuff, aren't you?
What?
You guys are too old for that stuff, aren't you?
No, not at all. Never.
Okay.
Too old for that.
Just making sure.
and I hope it helps a little bit. I don't even know what joke you were making there, but I'm
Lisa knows.
I finally got my I'm embarrassed to shoot her out of the window.
Out of the window?
Yesterday. Oh my God, I can't believe that.
That's a good thing.
Well, you know what? Speaking of air conditioners and windows, believe it or not, that's probably one of the number one places where birds like to nest during the wintertime.
I've had pigeons do that and so that's a reason to get your air conditioner
in.
Speaking of pigeons,
there.
And of course in the second hour we'll be talking about a different kind of pigeon, the passenger pigeon. Rick, I got a couple of reports here on Twitter. Zan.
And we'll get into the details of the forecast.
Right. Rogers Park, she said, looks like 8 inches. I don't know if she has an exact measurement, but she has 36-inch drifts and shoveled piles 5 feet high, which a lot of folks have right now.
Without a doubt, right along the lakefront, Mike, we have easily 3 to 4 foot drifts.
And Ann Sparrow in Indiana says, in central Indiana, our snowmageddon is just getting started.
Right. They're going to get probably up to about 12 inches out of this event.
Yeah. Early this morning, she says it was beautiful outside. So those are at least a couple of reports. What? I guess we have an extensive forecast, so have at it.
Yeah. You know what? I think it's one of these things where I think people really need to let go of the fact that weather people, this is not hyping the weather. The stuff that's going to come through here tonight and tomorrow is dangerous. It's life-threatening. It's the kind of stuff that comes through, I'd say, maybe every 20 years. And the reason why I say that is because overnight lows tonight may actually be warmer than the afternoon highs tomorrow. The core of the coldest Arctic air is expected to come through sometime between about 8 a.m. and about noon tomorrow. So the temperatures to the north of us right now, I'm looking at Green Bay at 5 above and a wind chill of minus 12. And they're playing football up there later on this afternoon. It's not the noon game, Mike. It's the late game.
Oh, my goodness.
Kickoff temperatures for Green Bay could easily be about minus 5 or minus 7. A wind chill of about minus 25 to minus 30. This could easily go down as the third coldest day or the third coldest game in NFL history. I don't know how they're going to play in this stuff.
Well, they're having a tough time giving tickets away, I heard.
Yeah, and I think what happens is people look at the weather forecast, they go, I'll just sit inside and watch it. But, you know, cold has a lingering effect to you, Mike, and that's what I'm getting at here. Temperatures tomorrow morning at 7 or 8 o'clock could be about 12, 13, maybe 14 degrees below zero. By noon, they may only be about 50 as the coldest air comes over us, and they'll still be anywhere between 15 and 20 below zero by Monday night into Tuesday morning. Tuesday afternoon's high temperature may only be about 5 degrees below zero. So oftentimes we talk about how extreme weather may not set within the first hour. It has a lingering effect. It has a cumulative effect, just like heat. It's not the first day. It's not the second day. Sometimes it's the third day. So what we want to make sure people understand is if you think you're going outside tomorrow and you want to go, oh, it's really not that bad, by later on in the afternoon, your car goes, I told you, I didn't want to start up this morning. I'm not going to start up now. Then what are you going to do? So I know the city of Chicago hasn't made a decision yet, or if they have, I may not know about it. But tomorrow, give the kids the day off. This is not a day to be outside. So afternoon temperatures right now in the teens. The cold air begins to move through by about midnight tonight. We should be down about 5 below. Tomorrow morning, about 15 below. Tomorrow afternoon, the high may only be 12 below. and that will put us in record territory where the all-time lowest high temperature for Chicago is minus 11. So daytime highs may not get above minus 10 and will stay in that range with wind chills of 30 to 40 degrees below zero into Tuesday morning. We may not see anything close to 10 degrees above zero until probably Wednesday. So again, cumulative effect. If you think you want to go outside and shovel, do it before about 3 or 4 o'clock. Don't wait until tonight, and certainly don't do it tomorrow.
That's wise words. I've just got another report. Beyond the Oath has 8 to 9 inches in Frankfort, new snow.
Yeah.
And Annie Haven in California says, sending you some California sunshine. Thanks, Annie.
I want to help people in Sunnyvale, California, going to be watching the Packers and the 49ers play football this afternoon. Probably with a big smile on their face.
That is going to be crazy. Rick, thank you so much for your wonderful, wonderful work. And in the next hour, get back to me. It sounds like we know what's coming, and we will talk next week.
Sounds good, Mike. Stay warm.
All right. Take care. Second hour, Joel Greenberg. A fascinating conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it, about the late, great passenger pigeon. So stick around.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees. And by Recycled Granite, featuring eco-friendly split stone veneers and handmade products by individuals with disabilities. Go to recycledgranite.com. Here he is again, Mike Novak. Take me out, I say, you don't show.
Yeah, but maybe not today. Maybe stay in. Well, actually, today's not the bad one, as Rick said, and his advice is well taken about being careful about how long you stay out there. However, if you have the opportunity, I know that Rick's just being careful because he needs to be careful, and I'm going to be careful. I want people to be careful too, but if it's 20 degrees below zero, you got to experience it. You got to bundle up for, you know, for a minute and go outside, or 5 minutes, and just experience it. That's the way I feel. It's different if you're lacking heat or you're stuck at a bus stop like our intrepid Carol Brewer. You made it.
I did make it.
Welcome.
Here I am. Hello. Good morning, everyone.
You had a little bit of a trauma getting here this morning.
I did. It was an experience, you know, but
couldn't,
I'm a trooper.
Couldn't get out of the alley, huh?
The alley. And, it, you know, I have a little car. I have a four-wheel drive, but it's little, so.
You have four-wheel drive, you still couldn't do it, huh?
Yeah, because it's so, it's not a truck. It's just
right.
A ride. It's low.
Thank goodness.
It's low. And
low rider.
It's low rider. But yeah, I thought the bus would be a better option, but it ended up to be a more interesting option, I guess I should say.
Yeah, so you ended up going to the bus stop, and then you couldn't get a bus, I imagine.
It took a while to get a bus, and there were no cabs.
No cabs.
No cabs. So any cabbies out there around Foster and California, we need cabs.
You know what? I talked about that earlier. That's the Western Avenue rule.
You know, what do you mean? Oh, you got to go to Western Avenue to get a cab?
You have to go as far east as Western Avenue. Anybody who lives in the city of Chicago knows that.
Yes.
That's the rule.
Yeah.
And with certain exceptions. One is getting off the freeway. If you get off at, if you're at Irving Park and the freeway, yeah, you can get a cab. If you're at Addison in the freeway, sometimes you can get a cab. But yeah, most of the time, you're west of Western, going to happen.
Definitely.
You're not going to get a cab.
Definitely.
And it's annoying.
And I knew that, but I was just keeping my eye out just in case. But the bus tracker said that the bus would be there soon. So
any day the bus will be there. I have to say one thing that I didn't tell Rick DeMaio, but if he's still listening, I know he will appreciate this. I'm watching the Weather Channel yesterday, trying to keep up on the weather. And right now, watching the Weather Channel, it, for me, is painful. It's painful because they keep naming these.
I was just going to ask, are they naming things?
They are
today?
Naming these damn storms. And it's just, and I'm watching this cute little thing on the Weather Channel say, well, we're watching the storm today. The storm's name is Ion. And I'm, and Kathleen can verify this. I'm screaming at the TV. The storm doesn't have a name. It doesn't have a name. It's just a storm.
And who names them? Channel.
Oh, yeah. It's all, folks, if you don't know this, that's their deal. Nope. The National Weather Service does not name these winter storms. They name hurricanes, which led to this, of course. And now the Weather Channel's doing this, and it's making me nuts. It's just silly. Okay?
Well, they had hurt. It's pretty unanimous that everybody hates this.
Yes. Well, except the Weather Channel.
Don't they realize?
Maybe we could start a petition. Maybe we need a Move On petition to get the Weather Channel,
please, Weather Channel
to stop.
Stop.
Please stop naming storms. Please. Please stop doing that. So I've decided, I think they provided my next column for Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. I'm going to do a column about naming every event that happens in my life. You got to have a name for it. So you dig a hole, the hole becomes hero, the hole that I just dug. Or what? Let you mow the lawn. It becomes Max. Max the mow. It was a good Max.
Oh my God.
Yeah. It's, you know, if it's fodder, if it's grist for the writing, that's always a good thing. It's the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk AM and FM. If those of you experiencing weather, yeah, you got lots of it. We're happy to have you here. Mayo's extended forecast in the 9:30 hour. I hope you caught our new segment. We have a new gardening segment every week, 9:15. What do we call it? In the Green Room with Mike. That's the new name.
Oh, that's nice.
I like that.
I missed it. Sorry. I was trying.
Yeah, you were at a bus stop.
The bus.
What? You weren't streaming me on your cell?
Well,
what's wrong with
the
you?
The bus didn't have it streaming.
I don't know why.
CTA, about it.
CTA on the phone right now. All right. I don't know why they don't have this show on. All right. Talking about writing and having the creative juices flowing, we are going to go to the phone lines and bring in author, naturalist, Joel Greenberg. Joel, good morning.
Well, it's quite the day out there. And you've commented that people ought to experience adverse weather when you'll remember for us old guys, when it was 25 below zero one day, decades ago, I went out and did a little birding and actually saw a robin. I agree. You should at least sample it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. An email from Dan Costa over at Vern Goer's greenhouse in Hinsdale. He says he was just watching his resident rabbit digging in the snow under the bird feeder and eating the fallen bird seed. He seemed to know the seed was there.
Well, we had a Cooper's hawk a couple days ago right next to our feeder. And so bird feeding, you know, you put out seeds to feed the birds. Well, now you track the birds to feed the Cooper's hawk. So everybody enjoys this.
Well, okay, you're an expert at this because you are a birder. Is there such a thing as a master birder?
Not in the way that there's a master gardener or master naturalist. No, not a formal program.
There should be, you know, because you would qualify. Let's get some information out before we talk about your book.
Okay.
About what folks should be doing with this huge snowpack. Is this a time to feed birds or can they manage by themselves?
Well, I mean, I think birds can manage by themselves. There's probably some mortality as a consequence. I mean, this is part of their evolutionary history. On the other hand, you know, you provide food for them, and it certainly, you know, would probably help those birds that have access to your feeder. Some birds, hummingbirds, have lingered into the winter, and clearly, you know, they wouldn't survive if it weren't for the handout of perpetually warmed sugar water. So, yeah, and also it's, you know, you're stuck in your house on a day like today. Sing something alive, and even if they're just house sparrows or starlings, these ubiquitous aliens of the Ruidera world, it's kind of neat to see something alive. Or the squirrel. We have two kinds of squirrels. The fox squirrels are being driven out by the grays. So the fox ate first, and then later the grays came. And so for me, seeing wildlife, is pretty neat when you're when you're limited as to where you can go.
I was in reading A Feathered River Across the Sky. I noticed that you refer to what used to be called English sparrows. They're not called that anymore?
No. The American Ornithologist Union formalizes bird names, and for quite a while now they've been called house sparrows. There's a trend away from proper nouns, and it's been called house sparrow quite a bit now.
Blame somebody, so if we can blame the English, that's always a good thing.
There used to be a bird called the English storm petrel, or the British storm petrel. Most of them nested in Ireland, and as you can imagine, Ireland was really annoyed that this bird that nested mostly in their borders was given the enemy's name, as it were.
Well, several years ago, I put out a bird feeder in the backyard for the winter, and I thought, oh, this is going to be fun. I'm going to get to watch all kinds of different birds over the winter and enjoy their presence in my yard, see some nature. And it was like 12 billion house sparrows showed up and about, three squirrels and a few pigeons. And that's what I got.
Over time, you'd probably get more variety.
But here's the other problem with that, is that if you put it over your garden in the spring, you're getting all kinds of stuff that is sprouting underneath it. How do you defeat that?
Well, that's a good... That happened with passenger pigeons.
Well, that might be our transition into your new book. Joel Greenberg has penned an excellent book called A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. Now, I'm looking at Facebook right now, and a fellow named Don Gorney, does it sound familiar?
My good friend from Indianapolis.
Who writes, someone please call in and ask if it is true that passenger pigeons went extinct because of the demand for pigeon on a stick at the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
And the answer is no.
No.
Okay.
I knew it.
Those are easy ones, Donna.
We didn't eat them all?
They did become extinct because they did become a commodity, and there was a market and an industry that exploited these birds relentlessly. There were people anywhere from 500 to 2,500, the literature varies, who did nothing, Mike, but chase the birds wherever they were.
And this is documented in your book. And to answer Lisa's questions, you just did, which is to say, yes, Lisa, people did hunt the bird and ate it relentlessly, but it wasn't by 1893. The bird was gone. All right, there were a few extant, but there wasn't going to be any passenger pigeon on a stick at the 1893 World's Fair.
Well, I remember the anniversary from last year, and it's so sad.
It is. It's a horrifically sad story, and so the place we start. All right, here's where I want to start with this, because this is reading your book. This is the question me in reading it and since reading it, and it continues to bother me, which is, why didn't I know about this before you first appeared on this program? I mean, an animal that existed in the billions that would take days for flocks to fly overhead, would block out the sun, would completely devastate forests because of the birds landing and dropping their waste products. Why is this not drummed and drilled into kids' heads in school?
You know, I can't answer that. If I had the resources and I've thought about it, it would have been interesting to do a poll to find out how many people know what the passenger pigeon is. I mean, obviously, a lot of the people I hang out with, if you're interested in birds or natural history or even cult, human history, people, if you ask most people, sometimes I've been surprised, but people might say, yes, I know what a passenger pigeon is, and then you ask them what it is, and they say it's a bird that delivered messages during the war. Well, that's Columbolivia. That's the common rock pigeon, the pigeon you see in the city. It's not this bird indigenous to the eastern half of the United States and Canada that, as you said, was the world's most abundant bird, and we wiped it out. Hundreds, you know, we don't know exactly how many, but there were surely hundreds of millions of them, you know, in the 1860s and early 70s. And, you know, 40 years later, they were gone. And so I don't know why we don't. I mean, I guess as a society, we tend to focus, as I say, you know, I'm interested in things that are more enduring than the Kardashian wedding. You know, I mean, we tend to, you know, focus on all the, you know, human-oriented stuff. So
yeah, well, you know, and I think the point is that part of that human-oriented stuff is we're interested who was in the White House and a couple of other things, and we lose the background. For instance, okay, I'll give you an example of how we lose that. And Kathleen Thompson, my partner, and as you know, has a website called onehistory.org. And she tells on that, she's written several books about history and done picture history, photo history, photojournalism. And she and her partner, Mac Austin, concentrate on the underreported parts of history and peoples in history, namely minorities, women, and children. They're all part of our history. They were there when George Washington was there and Abraham Lincoln and the Civil War was going on and other things were happening, but they're completely underreported.
In part because I suspect that population didn't leave much of a written record. I mean, there's just a lot.
Not as much, but there is some written record.
Sure.
And it's been summarily ignored, basically, by the power structure, which is male and white, as we know, and has been for a long, long time. Now, how that extends to our natural world, you know, including passenger pigeon, bison, and the other animals that were extirpated or almost extirpated. 19th century, a particularly brutal time?
It was, and basically what you had, I mean, you had things going on. You had obviously the United States population just, you know, growing tremendously. You had new technologies, and with respect to game, the passenger pigeon, other, you know, bison, you had railroads, you had telegraphs, which meant that you could transport things killed in remote areas to big cities, to the east, relatively easily. You had telegraph so that the hunters knew exactly, and let's just focus on the pigeons. The pigeons, I mean, you know, a roost, say 10,000 birds landed in some part of western Missouri, would take quite a while to know, but now the telegraph operators were specifically instructed to spread the word. So in no time, you had these professional hunters, you had the locals killing them, whereas, you know, it used to be possible they'd have a respite for a while. So anywhere they might be, basically, became accessible to this industry. And that was, you know, the North American wildlife paid a huge price. The Eskimo curlew was another bird, not as spectacular in numbers as the pigeon, but that is almost certainly extinct too, and the numbers plummeted when they were part of the market. Other birds were saved. You know, egrets and terns were used. They were converted into hat ornaments. And so the numbers, you know, so the technology and the growth of the population. Two things you said earlier, if I can just, one is you said it's a sad story, and it is, if you end it on September 1st, 1914, when Martha died, but
Martha was the final passenger pigeon.
She was born in Chicago, sent to the Cincinnati Zoo in 1902, and lived until September of 1914. The second to the last bird who shared a cage with her, named George. The thought is the zoo, I'm named these two birds after the Washingtons.
Brilliant.
He died like 1911. And so she was the last one for several years. But what that decimation of wildlife, the pigeon being one of, you know, the biggest things, bison were another, led first environmental movement. And that in turn led to the passage of the Lacey Act, which was the first federal law to protect birds, and then ultimately the Migratory Bird Act, which the Supreme Court in 1920, Missouri, that it was within federal jurisdiction to regulate on the taking of migratory birds. And that's sort of another point about the 19th century. There was no federal involvement in migratory birds. I mean, people, if you want to save the commons, you remember Garrett Hardin's book, Tragedy of the Commons, that was written in the 70s. Who's going to protect the air, the water, migrating birds? The only entity that can do that is government, and federal government, or, you know, that's why in the seas today that are being pillaged by, you know, international, by fishing in international waters, no country has control of it. So you need a sovereign that is willing to interject itself into protecting the commons. And so another aspect of what happened in the 19th century.
Yeah, but that's fraught with danger, too, because you know the way this country works, and states' rights are a powerful force. And every time you bring in states' rights, it's environmentalism for the most part, it seems to me.
Well, that's why the bigger the jurisdiction, i.e. the federal government, I mean, the Endangered Species Act, which has been an amazing thing, a wonderful thing, is under, but, you know, the first, it's often the case, I mean, Connecticut was one of the first states to protect birds. Illinois had a very strong Bird Protection Act. So eventually, that was in the 1890s, and eventually, you know, in the early 20th century, the federal government took it upon itself to say, you know, we have jurisdiction over these migratory birds.
As you say, had to do with the passenger pigeon because, as you so well put it in your book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, people seem to be a little dumbfounded that the bird was gone, because in the 1860s, billions, and then, of course, in when it disappeared, folks were making all kinds. They had all kinds of theories about what had happened. Well, they flew to South America. and you know, those. It occurs to me that those people today would be watching Fox News.
Well, the climate denial. Some of them, Mike. That's really perceptive of you, because it struck me too that some of the language. You know, people are going to lose their jobs if we do this. And, you know, God gave it here for us to use. And, don't worry, there's still plenty of fuel and there's plenty of water.
And they were saying that in the 70s and 80s. Don't worry, there's plenty of birds. You could never possibly kill them all off. And by the way, I should remind people, we're talking to Joel Greenberg, author of A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. As you mentioned, that as the bird was in decline, there was complete denial. All that sound familiar to you here in the 21st century?
It does. And the other thing that made it easier, I mean, A, there wasn't the communication back in you know, the 1800s. Also, because the bird flocked, you know, you could say truthfully as late as 1882 that maybe 3 million, 4 million birds were nesting in Wisconsin. See, there's plenty of them. The point is, 4 years before, there were 50 million that nested in a place. So they did aggregate often. I mean, they nested in other ways, too. But so the point is that there would be, at any given point, maybe a place where somebody could say, oh, there were lots of them. And the industry also made up, oh, they nested four times a year, and they had two eggs in a nest. They nested, produced one egg. So they actually manufactured aspects of the bird's life history, specifically to allay concerns that the birds were disappearing.
Do we call that today disinformation? And it is rampant in our society.
It absolutely is.
And it's also funded by billions of dollars.
Yeah, which back then, obviously it wasn't by that, kind of resources. So, yeah, no, absolutely. To me, that's why, somebody might say, okay, who cares about something that's been extinct for 100 years? But the lesson is, as a cautionary tale to the proposition that no matter how abundant something is, we can lose it if we're not careful. And now there's over 7 billion of us on this planet, hundreds of millions living at middle class, consuming a lot more than they did back then. So, whatever it is, it could be fuel, it could be water, or something alive. It's an important message that, you have to be certain you use things. It could be your own family checking account. It's finite, You have to treat it carefully or you're going to get in trouble.
Well, one of my favorite words at the moment is stewardship. One of the superior, intelligent species on the planet have a responsibility.
I use that in air quotes, intelligent, responsible species.
I'm using it in the sense of it is our responsibility because we know better. We should know better.
We should.
And ignorance is not bliss. Ignorance will lead to things like the extinction of species.
Well, and as Joel points out in the book, we are already the beginning or the middle of the sixth great extinction on the planet. And it makes me wonder, Joel, do you see the starting point as the 19th century and the destruction of so many species once our technology, basically what a lot of it had to do, as you said, railroad, communication, and guns. The sophistication of our guns could take out billions and billions and billions of birds. So do you see that as the starting point for the sixth great extinction?
Well, one of the things that I address, there are, my friend David Blockstein, an ornithologist, refers to them as the four horsemen of extinction. So, one is direct take. That's what happened to the passenger pigeon largely. In this country, more or less that's under control, more or less. There are laws and you can do only so much. There's three other things. There's habitat loss, which is rampant. There is pollution, which is rampant and which, ultimately is creating climate change. And the fourth one is, and this comes pretty close to home too, our introduced species. And that might include letting your cat wander out, cats kill hundreds of millions of birds a year, if not a billion, too. So the point is that there are all kinds of threats. And the second great environmental movement, spawned arguably by Silent Spring, her consummation of biodiversity, the web of life out there netting and shooting birds, by the hundreds of thousands, it was because of pollution. So the point is that as society is becoming more complex, there are more and arguably even more insidious, things we're doing that are reducing the number share of the planet. And, for some of us, that's not a good thing.
And as you mentioned in here, no, it's not a good thing. You also mentioned something that I talk about, and that's the metaphor of the airplane and removing rivet by rivet from a plane that's flying. And which is the species that we remove where the rest of it comes tumbling down?
Exactly.
And who is it that that came up with that idea?
Well, Paul Ehrlich wrote about it. Paul and Ann Ehrlich. He wrote the Population Bomb. He's at Stanford. I don't know if he came up with it. Perhaps he did, but I learned about it through his wonderful book called Extinction that he and Ann wrote in 1983, I think. So, eventually, and it's hard to know, exactly what that is going to be or when. I think it is a powerful, metaphor. We could see it on, we maybe have talked about you know, flooding. I mean, you change the vegetation. I mean, you change the surface of the land so that it no longer can absorb water. That water is going to go somewhere, and it may settle in the low point in your backyard or basement. You know, so even here in the Midwest, we can see the effects of removing, you know, simplifying the web of life.
We're talking to Joel Greenberg, the author of the excellent book, A Feathered River Across the Sky, The Passenger Pigeon's Flight to Extinction. I'm not going to bust you about the whole Diane Rehm show coming this Tuesday. Oh, wait, I guess I just did, didn't I?
No radio station is local anymore.
That's right. I've got my folks listening in California and on the East Coast and all over the world in Germany. They all want to buy the book. So, you know, you better let all your friends know when you're going to be on my program.
I try to, make amends, Mike.
and you didn't even show up today. No, I'm giving you a pass on that one. Yes. What time are you going to be on Diane's show on Tuesday?
Okay, I'm going to be on there at 10 a.m. Central Time.
Okay.
Let me say one other little Peggy note about Nature Museum, and Steve Sullivan and I were on your show back when talking about the Project Passenger Pigeon. They've been very involved, very helpful in spreading the word on this broader Project Passenger Pigeon, of which my book is one part. They're going to hold a reception for me on February 23rd, Thursday, at 5:30. The talk starts at 6. And so I would encourage anybody who happens to be at the Notabart vicinity, you know, which is at Cannon Drive and just north of Fullerton, to attend. One of the special guests is going to be Big Blue, the last wild passenger pigeon for which there is an extant specimen. I discovered this in my research. Big Blue is the motto of Millikan University, which is where the bird is, and the ornithologist from Millikan is going to drive. I think you said you were going to come, and I'm thrilled that you will be. I should also say one other thing. There's a movie, and David Mrazek, the director, and I were on Mike's show. So Mike is going to be the voice of John Audubon in our documentary, and that's moving ahead. Should be ready in April, if not even before. So we're thrilled, Mike, with your help and enthusiasm for this project.
Well, I am enthusiastic about it. I think it's, and other people have said, it's a cautionary tale. We need to be paying attention to this, and the 100th anniversary is a great time to do that. Listen, I want to talk a little bit more about that. We can talk about what's going on with the film. We've got a little more time here. I need to take care of some business, so hang on. We'll be back with Joel Greenberg, author of A Feathered River Across the Sky. And believe it or not, it's time to think about ordering seed catalogs for your 2014 garden. And if you listen to this show at all, you know I'm going to recommend that one of those catalogs be from D. Landreth Seed Company. Why? Well, since 1784, the D. Landreth Seed Company has been one of the most extensive selections of fine lawn and garden seeds in the world. Their founders, and this was before the passenger pigeon was exterminated in America, 1984, their founders introduced into the United States some of the most beloved flowers and vegetables known today, including the zinnia, came from D. Landreth, the white potato, various tomatoes, there's so many out there, and their own Bloomsdale spinach. And here's what's happening in 2014. Landreth is holding all of its prices. Now, because of this, there was no need to print a 2014 catalog, and they've also reduced the price of that catalog to $5 for this year. So to order some, and of course, you know how gorgeous, and this is why you want to have this catalog in your home. This is not something you throw away. This is something you hang on to and maybe pass it along to a friend. To order some of the finest heirloom and historic seeds on the planet, go to LandrethSeeds.com or their Facebook page, Landreth Seed Company. Actually, Landreth Seed Co., but that stands for company. Or call 800-654-2407. 800-654-2407. The D. Landreth Seed Company is America's company. D. Landreth Seed, kind seed since 1784.
Looking for a housing investment that can pay big dividends? Remodel your kitchen or bathroom. You'll freshen up your home and add value to it, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for all your remodeling needs. Kitchens, bathrooms, master suites, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Hi, my name is Peggy, and I publish Chicago's only local magazine dedicated to healthy and sustainable living. Natural Awakenings is available monthly, and we provide the latest news and trends about healthful living, including alternative and complementary medicine, fitness, good food and drink, healthy kids and families, and even healthy pets. Natural Awakenings also talks about local sustainability, gardening and environment, energy conservation, and green living. We feature local news and a calendar to help you stay connected. I can guarantee that each month you'll discover a new health tip, a tasty recipe, a service in your neighborhood, something that makes your life better. Natural Awakenings is free and available throughout the city and suburbs or online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697 to learn more. That's 847-85 Natural Awakenings. Feel good, live simply, laugh more.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, make it so. Make it so. Make it so.
Well, it is coming down out there still. I assume it's still snowing. I haven't looked out in a while. I got an email here from Dwayne, who says, "Hi, Mike. Here's a fun experiment for extreme cold. When it's minus 20 or colder, boil some water in a small saucepan. Then quickly bring the pan outside and throw the boiling water into the air. The hot water will instantaneously evaporate into a cloud of steam. Of course, take the necessary precautions to prevent burns." That's kind of cool. I might actually try that. We're talking to Joel Greenberg, author of Across the Sky. And Joel, of course, you've been on the program before talking about Project Passenger Pigeon. Explain exactly what Project Passenger Pigeon is.
This is an attempt to use this anniversary to let people know about it, to try to overcome the ignorance about it that you addressed, Mike, in some comments earlier. We want people to know about what happened to the bird and to divine the lessons, the messages from that story that are still relevant today. We have a website, passengerpigeon.org. We have over 160 organizations. The book is a major part of it. The movie is a major part of it. We're really fortunate. We're getting some really good press. Bird Watching Magazine is going to have an article come out next week. Audubon Magazine and Orion, more general environmental publications, are going to do stories. And The New Yorker, I was just thrilled. I mean, did a 3 or 4 page article. New York Review of Books, The Wall Street Journal, McLean Publications. So we basically, and then there's going to be exhibits. Peggy Notabart is going to have an exhibit on extinction. There's others across the country, even on the West Coast. I mean, places far removed from where there were passenger pigeons. A host of programming, Anthony Philip Heinrich was a 19th century composer who wrote a symphony about passenger pigeons. It appears likely that at least two orchestras, including the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is going to perform it. Brushwood Center, which used to be Friends of Ryerson in Riverwoods. And Mike, if you've never been there, we'll have to go because Sophie Twitchell, the director, they do a lot of things with art and conservation, trying to get, you know, people engaged in these questions through, through art. And so there's going to be an amazing exhibition in May called Moving Targets. And there's going to be just a host of things like that. And so I'm really pleased. We planted
Several things I want to mention, and I'm glad I just got an email, because I meant to mention this, because I know this is one of those questions that you're going to get every time you get interviewed about this. And that is, Clarissa writes to me, "Hi, Mike. Scientists are definitely talking about bringing the passenger pigeon back, and this is their first candidate. On the list of candidates, there's a mammoth. As well, Western scientists, as she writes, considered it inappropriate to try the same with the Neanderthal. But Chinese scientists might not give a darn." Well, I don't know if that's true or not. Dinosaurs are not yet on the list, but she says a raptor. What, the Velociraptor, whatever.
Oh, yeah, okay.
It might make a pretty awesome hunting dog. But that's something that I'm sure everybody's going to ask you, because it's the latest and the greatest story, which is, ooh, we're going to clone passenger pigeons and bring them back. First, what do you think about the possibility of that happen? Second, what do you think about it?
Well, I've been involved the the Long Now Foundation, which is Stuart Brand and Ryan Phelan's organization. They look at issues far into the future. They invited me to a meeting in Boston they were having on it. There are a number of candidates. My friend Ben Novak is working on passenger pigeons, a mammoth, something called the thylacine, the Australian wolf from Tasmania. So this isn't exactly cloning, and genetics isn't my strong suit. But you take DNA. So with passenger pigeons, they've had access to large 1,500 to 2,000 dead passenger pigeons in museums in the world. And so they've been extracting DNA. And the idea is, again, not really cloning. You then put that DNA into a close living relative, which in the case of the passenger pigeon, there's a genus of New World pigeons, which includes the band-tailed and the white crown. So they're using band-tails. And what you do is, it's like you take a band-tailed chassis, you change it by introducing this DNA from passenger pigeons. People much more expert in that than I think it can be done. I mean, I think that even if you were to create some small number of these things, mostly passenger pigeon maybe, but and even if you if you introduce them in the wild, they look so much like mourning doves, they would be shot. So you'd have to create more mourning doves are shot, I believe, than any other game bird. So, there's all kinds of social problems. So there's that. You would have to create a non-migratory population. You certainly could never replicate the spectacle of what, it was like when the sky at a time in the 19th century. Whether you want to or not, it's another story, but you certainly, aren't going to be able to do that. So they might be able to create these. I mean, smart, knowledgeable people think they can. Everyone doesn't agree. I guess in my mind, it's sort of an open question. But one of the things that I find, Mike, really what does resonate with me is that those who do know the story, and you're right, more don't than do, but those who do are moved by it. So I've, spent 4 years writing this book and working on Project Passenger Pigeon. Ben Novak, the geneticist, is working on bringing him back. I mean, he's been intrigued by the story.
Yeah, I had somebody write to me this week and said, is he a relative? But I believe he spells his with a V.
Yeah, it's different. And this is something, since 2011, there have been, at least that I know of, 4 novels that have been written with passenger pigeons as a major theme or setting for the books. So people, are still moved by this story. It's a powerful story. And so, just depending on your interest, it kind of manifests itself in different ways. So, I mean, I see that, the commonality of what I'm doing and those who are trying to bring them back,
Yeah.
And, I think it's going to be a challenge. And the more success they have, in a way, I mean, as you proceed with the genetics, then you've got to deal, you know, with the politics and culture. I mean, then you start getting the, once you take it out of the lab, then you have to start dealing with people. And, you know, then it becomes a you know, different story. But, you know, they're aware of it. And, it'll be interesting.
But you know, it does raise and I'm going to get to a phone call. Mike is hanging on, and I appreciate that. We'll get to him in just a second. But it does raise an interesting question, moral question, I guess, ethical question as well, which is people would say, well, how dare you tamper with nature and try to bring the bird back? Well, you tampered with nature in the first place by killing it off. Okay.
Oops.
Yeah. You know, so where, how can you possibly draw a line? I don't see how you can.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's an issue, and I think your response is a good one. You know, another issue out there is, if we think we can bring things back, would it make us any less careful? I mean, would...
No.
You know...
that's my answer, no.
Yeah. So,
in fact, Mike's got a comment on that. Mike, you're on Mike Novak's show. Good morning. Good.
Yeah, I just thought I'd call and say don't forget the plesiosaurs. You want to bring them back too, right?
Okay, sure.
Well, they're not talking about dinosaurs. I mean, they're talking about,
we made extinct. I know. I was just joking.
You know. Yeah, no, but I mean the other. But you know, I mean, I don't. There's no. Is there dinosaur DNA even available? But I mean, if there is,
that would be.
There probably is. You know, we can find ways to get anybody's DNA these days. But what's your comment, Mike?
Well, you know, I started work at a country club back in 1983, working maintenance, and you know, there's a lot of glass on the building, and birds would run into the glass usually in the swing seasons. You know, spring and fall. And it wasn't unusual to go out and find a half dozen dead birds about every day. And when I retired from there in 2K8, just about, 6 years ago or so, it'd be about that many birds would hit the window in a season, which means the good news is less birds were hitting the window, but obviously the reason was because there are just less birds.
You might be right about that, and Joel actually writes about how many birds are killed by buildings.
Sure. It was never the crummy birds, you know, the grackles and the crows and sparrows or anything like that. It was always the finches and the wrens and the, you know, the real nice birds. I don't know, it's because the quality birds, I guess.
Yeah.
I think their eyes, the other birds, trash birds, I guess they could see the glass or something. I don't know what, but I don't think I saw any of those birds ever picked up any of those.
Any observations on that, Joel?
Well, yeah, I mean, apart from, I don't make the distinction really with native birds, but it's migrants. I mean, a lot of these things fly at night. I mean, it's you are going to get, I mean, birds. Some of the crows are permanent residents, and they're diurnal. Grackles, I think, are diurnal. So you're mostly—I mean, you're getting a lot of nocturnal migrants. So that's one factor. And yeah, I mean, there is, in fact, if people are concerned about this, there's two different groups in Chicago that have monitoring during migration period. People are assigned, you know, buildings, and they go out and they rescue injured birds, and then they're rehabbed, those that can be. The Field Museum, you know, has people bring birds into them, and you know, there's a huge number of species and, you know, individuals. So it is a important factor in bird mortality, undoubtedly.
Yeah, these birds, you'd hear them, you know, hit. You could, you know, you'd hear them hit, you know, or I've even seen them fly into the window. So that was during the day. You say they hit at night too. Well, maybe but most of these were day hits, you know.
Yeah.
But another thing too, I notice I hardly ever see, like when I was a kid, it wasn't unusual, you know, back in the 50s, you know, like on a warm spring, like maybe late May, early June bugs just smack into the screens, you know, and you'd see them all over the ground. Now, I've noticed the decline in them, like back in the 80s and 90s, you know, and now I don't even know if they're still.
You know, what's disturbing about what you're saying, Mike, is exactly what Joel wrote in his book, which is there were people who would say, well, we seem to be noticing a decline in these birds, and other people say, oh, no, there's plenty because we just saw a grouping of several million, you know, in Ohio or in Pennsylvania or in Wisconsin. But the numbers were going down. We just didn't pay enough attention to it. And it does disturb me that you don't see June bugs and or crickets.
And those are quality insects. I mean, they're not crummy insects like flies.
you keep making these distinctions, Mike, between
Diptera, the fly. I mean, we try to eradicate those things.
Yeah. Well, Mike, listen, great contribution. I appreciate it. You have a wonderful Sunday and stay warm, okay?
Take care now.
All right. Bye-bye. We just got a couple of minutes left here, Joel, but he raises a good point. Mike's point is well taken, that again, and I don't want to beat people over. Yeah, I do. I want to beat people over the head with this. There are some of us raising the alarm about certain things going on the planet. Most people want to have business as usual, and this is exactly where we were 150 years ago when the decline of the passenger pigeon started.
One difference now is these things are being monitored, and so, you know, bird populations, I'm sure insect populations. So we don't have the excuse of ignorance that they had in the 19th century, when genuinely, you know, the passenger pigeon was never studied in the wild. So there's a lot we don't know. Now, we do know which species are declining, and at least at some level. So the importance that you do, and hopefully I do, we look at that and then hope to share it with a wider audience. But, you know, that as a society, you know, are monitoring these things. So that's something to the good. Could I promote one last little thing?
Go for it.
I now have my own website, so I just wanted to share that.
It's already on my page, but give us the URL.
Okay, well, geez, it's Joel Greenberg, Joel Greenberg's Natural History, and I guess I don't have the URL. But
I do. It's joelrgreenberg.com, joelrgreenberg.com. Of course, you are the author of one of the classics, which is the A Natural History of the Chicago Region. And I urge people to pick up Feathered River Across the Sky, read this, and understand where we have been and where we might be going if we're not paying attention. I have information about Project Passenger Pigeon, and when the movie comes out later this year, we'll certainly talk about that. I even have the link to your New Yorker review if people want to take a look at that. So it's all on MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, and it's all there. Joel, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and we will do it again soon. Good luck on Diane Reams.
Thank you so much, Mike. Take good care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
In just a second, Chicago's Progressive Talk's new show. So stick around for that. Here's a tip from the Care of Trees. For a lot of people, the holiday season is over and it's time to decide what to do with that Christmas tree. Now, this is sad. I've already seen several in the alley in my neighborhood. And that makes me sad because the city of Chicago offers free tree recycling, which started yesterday. Just go to chicagorecycles.org, chicagorecycles.org, and look for the press release that has information about Christmas tree recycling. It's available at 23 city locations now through January 18th. And starting January 10, limited amounts of free mulch will be available for residents to collect from all tree drop-off locations. Meanwhile, the arborists at the Care of Trees are always there for a talk about mulch, about pruning, about whatever your tree needs are. Call 800-508-9466 for a free consultation, 800-508-9466, or go to thecareoftrees.com. The Care of Trees, a Davey company. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545, or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
I'm so glad that the man who is hosting the show coming up next likes to rock out.
And I sure do.
And he just was. And that's Scott Duff, and he's the host of Give Us
Out
the Name.
Out Chicago. I know, starting really soon.
Like in about 5 or 6 minutes.
Five or six minutes, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about it.
Oh, well, it's a brand new talk show aimed for the LGBT community, but for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
We're all inclusive here.
We are.
Yeah, and we're going to be covering everything from politics, current events, but we're also going to make sure that we have a good time with it, talking about all the amazing things that happen in Chicago culturally within the theater scene and the music and restaurants.
You're going to make me jealous because I used to be really a part of the theater scene. Deep into that, but
yeah.
Who knows? Maybe I'll have to listen now to see how to
get
back
in. Well, I think you better come on in. Yeah, come check us out.
That's great. And who you got today, very quickly?
Well, today my co-host is going to be Ellen Miller. She's a blues musician in Gallabout Town, talking about the year in review that was the year of the queer that was 2013.
Yeah.
It really was.
It was a big year.
It was a big year.
For LGBT concerns. And it continues.
As it sure does. And, of course, we're going to be doing some celebrity dish, talking about, you know, the movies that are coming out and all.
Well, we welcome you, and I'm glad to have you
on. Well, thank you so much.
Except we got to vacate the studio, so we say here, go green or...
go home.
That's what we always say.